House Judiciary Committee, Friday, February 10th, 1978.
Call meeting to order. Actually, the first bill we're going to take up is House Bill 118. But before we take that up, one person here would like to testify on House Bill 727, because he hasn't catched a plane. So let's take out House Bill 727 first.
System in Haines for 10 years as of this April. I'd like to state that I'm in favor of House Bill 727. I feel that magistrates are full-time magistrates, and plus, of course, the others are too, that are competent to sit in any case that is generally handled by a district court except in civil cases. In this particular case, you're talking about magistrates, and there are 11 in the state at this time. Our duties are actually beyond normal district court activity, meaning we are actually coroners, recorders, and other activities that generally don't get too involved with what happens by a district court judge. And with the number of district judges, or rather full-time magistrates that we have, I personally can't see where this could be too much of a problem if we became under the retirement system as district judges. The thing is that the majority of people that come before the courts are the first person they generally meet is a magistrate. And in the last 5 to 6 years, especially full-time magistrates have received continual training. We've gone out to various law schools, Alabama and Reno and Boulder, Colorado, and I know others have too, so that we feel that we are certainly qualified in the level of the court that we're involved with. The bill is written in the companion bill in the Senate, I think is a good bill. It's very simple. I would suggest only that there be some additions made to it to fill in two other sections of the statute that cover the same subject. In Alaska Statute 2225020, where it states retirement pay, that is similar to Alaska Statute 2228060, which is retirement pay. And the only thing I would suggest into this bill is an addition be made to the first sentence in this. It says the retired justice or judge eligible for retirement pay shall receive, and so on, that in addition to retired justice or judge, if you then say full-time magistrate. In both that section, 020, and also in 2228060, you just clean up the bill a little bit.
What, you cited 2225020, and what was the other one?
2228060. Those two sections actually are identical in wording.
Do magistrates receive any retirement time?
We are under under PERS.
I see.
Which we actually can pay, of course, portion of our pay is supplied by the state and a portion there, but we are, I think, are in a different status, and it's obvious that the it's a better benefit to us, you know, you're trying to hide that fact, to be under the district court retirement. And there is about, and again, not to try to cover up anything or hide anything, there are possibly three of the 11 magistrates who are could retire the next year or so. I could be one of them, although I don't intend to, unless somebody decides I have to go. So what we're looking for mainly, I think, is to for the benefit of the other magistrates that are going to be there for years to come.
Mrs. Bell?
No,
ma'am.
So other questions for
me?
Mr. Lyle?
Mr. Chairman, will there be someone here from the Legal Retirement to explain the difference in the program?
No. Is anybody here from retirement?
Well, are you planning to move this bill today?
It's up to the committee.
I thought we were just going to hear one that wasn't really
scheduled. No, there's other people ringing. We have quite a few other people.
I have a lot of other questions, but I don't think it's going
to. We're going to have a lot of other testimony today.
I'll miss them.
Yeah.
My question would deal with the difference in the two systems, is all. I suspect we'll have some of you.
There's no doubt that to be under the state or the district court retirement system is better for us. We don't question that at all. I think the thing that I would like to say, is I think that we deserve it. Where magistrates are on duty 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the main reason I have to rush home is because my clerk is going on vacation, and I would leave the town without a magistrate. And it isn't, our duties are not involved with sitting in court and on criminal or civil cases. That's only maybe 20% of the activities we have. I often say I would trade anything for just getting out of going to a coroner's case where somebody shot his head off. And I think that it is a lot more demand to me to be a magistrate or a sequel to a district judge.
Liam? I mean, the district judges, they don't act as coroners.
Not if there's a magistrate in their district. They can be called to as coroners.
Like
Anchorage, as an example, their district judge or Juno wouldn't be required because they would have a coroner administrator in their area if they had that job.
But for the most part, you say the magistrates are called upon to be.
Right. They're coroners, they're married people, that is statistics, recording. The judges are quite lengthy.
Judge,
thank you for putting me on first.
Okay. As I said, I originally had House Bill 118 scheduled first, so I'd like to go back to that now. We'll continue taking testimony at 727 as soon as we get done with 118. Okay. Does anybody have House Bill 118? Mr. Lassen, since you're sponsoring the bill, would you like to explain the bill to the committee first?
Chairman, you know this bill was introduced early in the session last year, and there were no hearings on this bill in resources. And at the appropriate time, it was decided that best we hold it over for 1 year to get the input from those who would affect. And since that time, we've had a considerable amount of support to enact this particular piece of legislation. What it does is, back in 1970, some I'm in an embarrassing position of trying to take something off the books I put on back in 1970. Anyway, what I did at that particular time, the purpose of putting this into state law was that what we assumed to be a threat from outside fishing interests, particularly those who vessels over the 58-foot length, that was the prior to the time of written entry, they could come into Alaska. And we tried prior to that time to enact a limited entry bill, which was taken to court and proven unconstitutional. But we found that to regulate the size of same boats, which eliminated a certain amount of boats that come into Alaska waters, it was a broad limitation on everybody, residents and non-residents. So, and that's the purpose of this particular piece of legislation. But since that time, of course, we've enacted the limited entry laws, which allows only so many units of gear in the salmon fishery. So we don't really have that problem. And I suspect one of the strong arguments for taking this off the books and putting it back in the Board of Fish would be that it's a regulatory function. It really isn't something that should be lacking in concrete, lacking state law. So I suspect there is some apprehension in some areas of the state over this change. They see some threats. I don't really see them myself, but those in other areas who operate smaller boats are more apprehensive about it. But I suspect the Board of Fish will probably hold public hearings and have enough input from these particular areas is in favor of keeping limitation on. I suspect they will size boats from certain management areas. But I'm confident that those same hearings are held in southeast Alaska, they would overwhelmingly like this limitation to be removed. The reason the support I've had for this particular bill is that it allows these vessels, allows these fishermen to hold salmon seine permits diversified to get involved in the ground fishery, which I'm sure we're going to be in the middle of here in the next few years. I suspect they could link their boats maybe 10 feet and still be adequate to compete in the seine fishery, but also large enough to get an offshore fishery, which I think Alaskans want to be and should be involved in.
Dick, was it also true in, when was it, 1970? Was it also true in 70 that not only were you getting outsiders coming in, but that probably there weren't very many Alaska boats over that size already, or were there?
No, I don't, as a matter of fact, there were boats over that size in the fishery in Alaska at the time, but they were in the false pass area, and there's exemption for those particular boats, the grandfather clause. These boats would come through the last waters and fish the false pass fishery owner, which is a deep sea fishery. But I'd say no.
Now it's more, there probably would be more likelihood that Alaska vessels over that length would appear if we
had lifted it. There wouldn't be an increase in number of vessels, it'd be increase in size. Okay. There are only so many permits available.
Right.
And I suspect that there'd be a number of permit holders which will enlarge their boats or purchase larger vessels so they can diversify. You know, the situation we're in now, they'd have to buy two boats.
Any other questions for Mr. Lyon? I think Mr. Richard Burgess would like to testify.
My name is Victor Burgess. I'm a resident of Heidelberg, Alaska for 29 years.
Yeah.
I'd like to testify against this bill on personal reasons, but I can't... the industry has varied quite a bit. Fishermen are individuals, actually. And I think that I'm speaking for one of us that's practically extinct, and that's the independent fisherman who hasn't got the entire backing of a cannery. The fact of the matter is, I'm not sure who I could sell to next year even, if I'm not independent. All I can see this bill doing for me is depreciating the value of my boat, and all the boats like mine, because my type of boat, which is 43.6 along the keel, about 50 overall, is good for nothing else but sinking. That's all. Just not the type of boat that you can really troll with. You can't gill net with it. Out of it, fishing is pretty well covered. I can't. The only point that I can see this bill is doing is giving a little extra push to industry. For me, people like me, which I think I can speak 100% for Heidelberg, it does nothing at all. Nothing. It's just like the limited entry bill. It actually done nothing for us. Our children can't get licenses now. There's no way. This original limit, it didn't stop the outside boats from coming up. All they did was change the rudder, shape of the rudder, or get vessels that would comply with the regulation. All you have to do is stand out on the dock in Alaska and catch can. See the boats coming up in the spring. Trollers, gill netters, seiners. Southeast is especially different because the majority of them are not Alaska, no matter what the limited entry commission says.
Any questions?
Even though we disagree on this, I don't know if fisheries are probably as many years as you have, and I'm also an independent fisherman. I have a 52-foot boat, but nevertheless, evidently the 58-foot limitation really didn't affect you to start with because of the size of your vessel now. Because it's not up to the limit, so I don't really comprehend what's going to be valued the vessel, the value of your vessel if it's not the limit boat. But it seems to me that how do you visualize this being detrimental to you or to anyone else who holds the same permit, when in fact, for a management tool, it's not a very good tool. They regulate the length the same, they regulate the depth the same, they regulate the areas, they regulate the opening and closed periods. So it seems to me that the length of the vessel doesn't make a heck of a lot of difference as a management tool.
Well, it does to a certain extent. You can't regulate the weather. And as it stands now, I'm sure industry, bigger industry, I have a lot of crab boats, boats that are way over the limit, they can use in this. They can not only hold their fish for an entire week, but it eliminates the, in some cases, having to hire packers. So I know many of the times I wish I had a 70 or 80-foot boat so I could go around Cape Jack, all time especially. So there is an edge as far as competition for them.
Well, being an independent fisherman, I suspect you understand competition, we all do. But by limiting competition, by enacting legislation which ties the hands of fishermen, doesn't enhance competition. It seems to me that I thought we learned a lesson here a few years ago when we had the scallop fishery. We found out, us who live in Alaska, there was a scallop fishery out there that was too late. They brought the feed from the East Coast, and they had these scallops pretty well corralled by the time we even got wise to it. Then we evolved into a crab fishery, and you and I know that the vast majority of the crab delivered in Alaska are delivered by people from Ballard. And now we're confronted with the opportunity to get involved in the bottom fishery. And it seems to me that there are people in people who like to compete, who want to modernize, who want to get in that fishery, we are keeping handicapped at the present time. We're either forcing them out of the salmon fishery, or else forcing them into buying two boats, one to get in the bottom fishery and one to utilize their entry permit for salmon sailing. We're giving them a tough choice. What we're trying to do is say, well, here's your opportunity. If you can build a vessel that's 10 foot longer than what the limitations are now, but if it could be utilized in the same fishery, you can seine and you can also compete for the offshore fishery. You can get involved instead of being forced to limit your operations at the size of your boat.
Well, I can see it, but there are competitors, and then there are people like me, which I think are in the majority, are very happy making a moderate living from it. And I think the competitors are in the minority. Really highlighters.
That's why they become highlighters, because they're competitors.
Why should we give them?
Well, they're independent fishermen. That's why they're independent. I don't have any.
So this is a great situation. Two honorable gentlemen who disagree sitting at the same table can ask anything. Wonderful.
But it's fish. All of them disagree. Serve on resources.
What effect on the actual fishing harvest, and Mr. Burgess and Dick can answer this, or you can each give your own opinion. Would lifting this limitation have? We spend millions and millions and millions of dollars on fisheries rehabilitation every year. I wouldn't know a salmon from a red snapper. Shooting completely in the dark. But what effect on this careful process we have of regenerating our fisheries resource would lifting this ban have? Is somebody going to catch tremendous numbers of more fish? And thereby, really, we just have a substantial impact on how we're tracking with the fisheries rehab program?
Well, let's say it could, because we don't know what the regulatory measures are going to come out in the fishing game. But it could make a tremendous impact, or it could be minimal. You take outside noise island, for instance. I've been blowing in many times from a westerly out there. Let's say a big run is out there. I can't get out, but Big Boat would. He might load up that day. So it could be tremendous. But then again, well, you don't know. You have to, are the runs there? Is the weather that bad? So it's things that can't, I could definitely answer. There's a possibility, yes.
Jeff, I'm not trying to pick you guys.
Well, no.
First particular game, if they thought the fishery was going to be detrimental with that particular, they wouldn't open to start with.
But that screws everybody.
Well, they wouldn't have fished out of inside water, so vessels his size could get involved. But
then the new big boat owners are going to raise hell.
I guess the point is that at least my impression is that they have the tools. They have all kinds of management tools.
Yeah.
So if there is a danger, they're certainly going to shorten the season, shorten the scene or something. But I say a 50-foot boat, he can catch as many fish on the inside waters as somebody said there was a 65-footer.
Outside.
Inside. In like competitions, everything's the same except the size of the boat.
Well, that means you can haul a hell of a lot more fish in.
But how many times have you loaded up in the last 10 years?
Twice, last summer, one day after another. One day I could have loaded up, but I couldn't sell my fish.
It's a little further. I just heard this morning that there was 130,000 pounds of bottom fish delivered a few days ago, 80,000 pounds today.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I'd have to agree with your proposition in the bottom fishing. I don't see where this retaining this limit is actually going to hurt somebody that's going to invest $500,000 or $600,000.
Just one further remark. You know, $500,000 to buy a 58-foot boat nowadays, that's all.
I know.
So,
I'm talking probably a lot more than that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Other committee members have questions?
Just one more. Do you think that, do you generally agree or disagree that the legislature should be involved in running regulations or putting things in statutes which should rightly belong in the Board of Fish or the Board of Game? In other words, should we say, well, we think it's a good idea to limit the same to 200 pounds, so we'll write a law and then we'll put it in the books, and you can go to the fish board from now on and they can't do anything about it. You think this is a good management approach?
Speaking personally, I have absolutely no faith in the Fish and Game Department or the Fish and Game Board.
It sure doesn't change over the years, does it?
How about the legislature?
That's why I'm here. I'm saving your job.
That may be a minority opinion.
Yeah.
Thanks. I don't think so. The court of last resort.
Being a
guild,
you
can
agree.
I think we'll be very objective on this question about seniors. Is there any more questions? Thank you, Victor.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Osterbeck, I'd like to testify now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Alan Osterbeck. I'm from Sandpoint out in the Shumigan Islands. And I've been looking at this bill that passed out of my committee when I was in Washington, D.C. on E2 lands, and it went up with any amendment. I think I was very when it went up, but it's an amendment. But since that, I've been calling. I called King Cove yesterday. They want to limit the taken off. One guy from Sandpoint with that 50-foot boat, he wants the limit off. He said it'll decrease the value of his boat if he puts the limit off. Some of the guys that built crab boats, they're 22 feet wide and 50 feet long. They look something like a sheet of paper here. They only make about 7 knots. And they built them for that. They figured his limit will come off and they can put 20 feet in the middle and get a boat that'll make about 2 more knots an hour with the same power. I don't know if you all know, we put all kinds of regulations on ourselves, and there's none on the foreign fleet, but we're still putting regulations on ourselves, and this regulation came up through Southeast. It's just a selfish regulation. They wanted to stop the Seattle fleet from coming into Southeast for the big purse takers. It went all along southeast, came to Kodiak, and I said in a couple of years it'll be in Sanford. Finally came out in the original chain. The only ones benefited by this regulation was the shipyard. You had to take all the boats down and cut them off. It was an expense to the fishermen. And if you look at all our regulations we're putting on the fisheries, we put area regulations on. I told them it's the worst thing they could ever do. Because right now they built a fleet up in each area. Before we had a mobile fleet, a lot of them came out of Seattle. They spent about 3 weeks traveling. The fishing didn't look good out of Unimac Bight. They went to Kodiak. Or they went to Southeast, and then they wind up in Seattle. We put a regulation on where they can't move. So if you're only catching 100 fish a day, they have to stay there, and I told them it'll defeat the fisheries. So now we built up, with our regulations, a fleet in every area, every district got a fleet. If you took that area licensing off right now, the way Chicknick fishery has been the last couple of years, you'd have 500 boats in there in 24 hours, which would deplete their fisheries right there. And this is what we've been doing, putting regulations on and not realizing what we're doing. We're still doing that today in the legislature. Somebody will come up with a good idea, let's put a regulation on it where you can't do this or you can't do that. But we're doing it for ourselves. And now we want to repeal them, which I think it should be repealed. For a simple reason, like I told you, some of the new boats are built 22 feet wide and 50 feet long, and they're not a good sea boat. They look like a box. They can't make any speed. They built them like that because they figured this regulation would come off, and they can add 20 feet in the middle, which will cost about another $100,000, but they'll have a decent boat there. And they still want a salmon fish. But they would be better for crab fish. Talking about the Ballard fleet, you just brought up here. I know all them guys when they got started. They got a grant, a federal grant, that's how they started. And after that, they used the boat for collateral so they could get another boat. Why, we're behind in the crab fishing in Alaska. We never had a loan program where we could build a thing. I've tried it for 20 years. I couldn't get a loan to build a 100-foot crab boat. That's why I'm working today, is trying to get a loan through where we can build a bigger boat and get some of the money in Alaska instead of in Washington or Valley, Smith Junction, whatever it's called.
I hope you don't retire from the legislature after you get the financing.
Well, I don't know, that's unbelievable. I better make some use of it. What I'm going to say on the shield thing, I talked to Nick Sabo in Kodiak, and he said, if this regulation is taken off the book, it'll be controlled by the Board of Fishing and Game. And they said it wouldn't be legal to say Southeast won't have a limit on their salmon boats, but the rest of it, Alaska will. And if that's true or not, I didn't ask a lawyer about it, but this is what they told me. And on the spring meeting, they'll say, Kodiak don't want to lose and chain of one. Southeast will have it. But it's up to the people, the fishermen over there. Like, I think it's a split vote in my district right now where they want the limit taken off, and the majority vote will be just like the House. It'll either stay on it or go out. And after that, I can't say it's going to happen. But it's one thing what we do. We put too many regulations on ourselves on fisheries. And we got a foreign fleet out there that had no regulations. The foreign fleet takes anything they catch and keep it, and we can't keep stuff. We get arrested. We caught with a halibut on, and, you know, they don't give us any percentage of a lot of fish where they give the foreign fleet there. So what I'm trying to say is we should look at bills we're passing, putting restrictions upon our fishermen, and look at what the foreign fleet is doing. And if we're going to compete with them, we have to have bigger boats. This bill won't help us to get bigger boats. If anybody thinks it'll help us to get bigger boats, you're better than state. What we need to get bigger boats is a good loan program where we can buy them, because there's nobody going to give you a bigger boat. If we pass this bill or not, the people that have money will get the bigger boat and still send it. But it isn't going to help me or any one of us in here would want to buy a bigger boat unless we get a loan program. That's about all I have to say.
Any questions from Mr. Osterbeck? Lisa?
Al, if you had had a chance to amend the bill in your committee, how would you have amended it?
Well, what I was going to amend was illegal. I would have held
it. You mean that it would only apply to Southeast?
Right.
I see.
So I said I would have held it until I got more information. Terry talked to me about it today, and I told him to go ahead and do what he wanted with it. Because I've had a chance to talk to the people in my communities, I said it's a split vote. If there's some wanted off, the guys who got the the little boats wandered on, the guys who got the big boats wandered off, so they were sent there.
If we were to put in here a provision after the repealer that the department should, by regulation, determine the maximum length in various parts of the state, the reason I ask it is because very few people express confidence in the Department of Fish and Game.
That would be real good if the story of the material.
What was that, Lisa?
That we put in here a provision that the department would, by regulation.
Well, it's not the department, it's the board.
The board.
The board would, by regulation, what?
Determine the maximum length allowed in any particular area.
You mean that they would have to take an affirmative action? See, if we pass the bill the way it is, then the board has the power to come in to any area and impose a limit.
Right.
Attempt to.
Right.
If we put in that they were required to do it, then we would leave it in limbo until as such time they come in and set a limit in each area. So I'm not sure which way you want to do it. One way would kind of have to wait until the board did something to impose a limit, because nobody then would know what the limit is in one area, and they're kind of, you know, they wouldn't know what type of boat to get.
Well, there are a couple of reasons for asking the question. One was I wanted just to find out whether Al feels enough confidence in the board to ask them to do that. Obviously, they have power anyway, but should we affirm that they ask them to do it? Do you feel
as
though you get a fair shake out of it?
Well, if you can do that, I think if you can put it in so it's legal, I think it would be a good thing. Maybe somebody else could have answered.
And then the follow-up would be, would it, as a matter of policy, be a good idea to
Mr. Lyons?
Well, now we're getting back in the same box we were trying to get out of. You know, we're taking something up, putting something else along with it. I had a hard time convincing them, hoping to get convinced that they will. Instead of putting the blanket back on and waiting another year for hearings to take off in certain areas, I said, hey, look, you know, maybe you aren't convinced, but I'm sure that if you hold a public hearing in Southeastern, they'd say, let us, you know, untie our hands. And if they hold it up in Sandpoint, maybe they'd say, well, put the lid back on so we get a chance to look at it. But I'm afraid we're getting ourselves in a situation where we'll be waiting another year. And I just think it would be important.
Well,
the
testimony we had in the research committee was from board members indicated that they would definitely look at the regulations this year if this was repealed. I don't think you have to tell them to do that. They're well aware of it and ready to act.
I think part of the problem we have is that there is some feeling that you want to do what, you know, the majority of the fishermen in a given area thinks would benefit the residents. And I don't think we really know. It's kind of hard for us. We haven't had a lot of people in from out in the chain or Kodiak or Prince William Sound. The board is better able to do it. Their spring meeting in April is going to be held in Anchorage. And I think we pretty much don't heard from a lot of people in Southeast. But the other areas, we just haven't heard too much from them. And the board is probably in the best position to sit down and say, well, what's best for each area instead of us trying to do it.
Just a little question on that particular subject. I'm sure that the board now, they have to have a certain time frame to advertise and look at the proposals that come before the board in the spring meeting. And I think we're at that particular time now. So I think they're going to advertise public hearings on length of votes. And even if we aren't repealed, they can still go ahead and put it in their regulations. And we can have it. If there are similar, we have a law, for instance, which restricts putting same gear on drums. They have a regulation that says the same thing. If we repeal a lot today, it would still be against their regulations. They do the same thing on 58, but they're advertising now. And whether we pass or not, they'll be able back come the spring.
Jerry? Yeah,
another point. Even if they didn't put any regulation on this year, I understand no one's going to go out and buy a bigger boat based on this repealer without the regulation being there. You know, that's like in this season, certainly no one's going to switch to bigger boats because it can't happen.
Are there any other questions
for
Mr. Osterbeck?
You're referring to these government funding for these larger boats. Well, you know, like I mentioned a while ago, that we hired a fishing game contractor with a gentleman by the name of Harry Ness on the East Coast to come to the Gulf of Alaska and have a survey on the kelp fishery. And he brought a boat around through the canal and up to the west coast and into the Gulf of Alaska, and he found a bonanza. And before, his report was in the department, the rest of that fleet was in Alaska. And that's the same person who used this funding method to build the crab boat. And from then on, he has maybe at least a half a dozen $1 million to $2 million boats now. And we can look back and trace it back. It probably stems from that research he did in Alaska on scale fishing.
When there was a lot of scale, they weren't depleted in Alaska. It's just no depletion.
They had a bonanza for years.
We only fished about 2 years. They went up to my district. A lot of the boats, I don't know what happened to them, but they couldn't get a crew, and they all went crab fishing. And finally, some of the boats are laying in Seattle, they got abandoned. There were old
There's
boats.
There's still two or three of them in my district, I don't know.
Fishing in Connecticut. Already fishing?
Yeah.
Well, there's no more fishing up the other way.
Thank you, Mr. Austin.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Lyon?
Yeah.
What action do you need to take in this bill?
We move the bill out of committee.
There's action. Change the motion. Change the motion to provide this committee report.
Lisa, there's several other bills. There's one bill.
I know they're bills, but why don't we put them on here? One of them.
I don't think it would fit within the title, among other things, but they're really diverse things. One bill sets up, makes amendments to the Commercial Fisheries Loan Act. Another bill sets up a fisheries cooperative bank. And another bill would appropriate money to fund it. Mr. Osterbeck's, when he's held hearings on one of them, the other one was just introduced about 3 days ago, House Bill 766.
Mr. Chairman, one of those bills is in the House Finance Committee, yeah.
Well, it's moved through my committee already.
Oh, the amendments to the Loan Act?
Yes.
What does that do? Does that make you able to borrow more money?
Right. As a matter of fact, I never had a bill that fit the title of the second
year, too. You did what?
The governor had only one to approve the second year, and that was dropped back to too, so...
You've got yourself well taken care of. You don't need my help,
Brad. They never need your help.
We're just glad to hear of your concerns.
We got commercial fishing sitting all over the legislature.
If you keep wondering why the minority leader is
always down in
there. Oh, I know about him. He represents the east side of Anchorage, right?
Yeah, the lower east side.
Okay, is there any other discussion on the motion to move the bill out of committee?
There's no objection in the bill from the committee. Okay, we'll take testimony now on the House Bill 727. And I thought I'd fly you there. Okay.
Last one was fishing.
I'm glad they had never had the same neighbor.
I'd like to hear from Mr. Jamie Fisher next on House Bill 727, since he has to leave, and then we'll hear from Leo Schaefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I realize that this is out of order, and I do very much appreciate the indulgence of the sponsor. yourself and the other members of your committee by letting me go forward. I'm James E. Fisher. I'm an attorney. I've been a resident of Alaska for more than 22 years. I've been licensed to practice law in the state of Alaska for more than 21 years. I have practiced in front of one of the judiciaries who would be a beneficiary of this particular legislation. That particular judicial officer is Magistrate Jess H. Nicholas of Kenai. Magistrate Nicholas has arrived at this particular position in his career by reason of having been a magistrate in a very difficult area, commencing on the 20th of February, 1960, when the court system began. He will probably tell you a little bit more about that himself, if you afford him the opportunity, and he might even tell you about a prisoner he had at that time. However, I'm not here for that. I'm here to speak in favor of the passage of this particular legislation. I'm also here as secretary of the Kenai Peninsula Bar Association, which is one of the local, and I suppose you could call it constituent bar associations, of the Alaska Bar Association. That particular organization, the Kenai Peninsula Bar Association, claims to encompass all of the Kenai Peninsula and has been in existence for, let's see, approximately 11 years as of the 21st of this month. We have always been interested in the judiciary and the advancement of the conditions under which the judiciary work. It would appear that this particular legislation would establish a more equitable condition for these judicial officers who are full-time magistrates. I think I speak with assurance and hopefully authority that as one who has practiced before a full-time magistrate, and maybe I have just been, the only word I can think of is blessed, and I'm not sure that's quite the term I want, is that I have practiced before Judge Nicholas, who has demonstrated all of the skill and capability that I have observed in other judicial officers up to the Supreme Court. And I think that if that type of skill and practice and service has been displayed, it should be equally rewarded by retirement and by the retirement advantage that would be afforded by this legislation, House Bill 727. I think I can state fairly that there would be a consensus of agreement of the remainder of the members of the Kenai Peninsula Bar Association on this particular legislation, and for some of the same reasons, because they too have practiced before Magistrate Nicholas, who is known as to be tough. When you're on the defense end, that can be kind of tough, but known to be fair. One additional comment, and that is the fact that not only would I speak in favor of the legislation, but I would also speak in favor of any other additional changes that might be required to Title 22 to bring that title in conformance with the spirit of this particular bill. It's my understanding there is the possibility of, just for conformance purposes and for consistency, there might be some language needed in some of the other sections of the Title 22. That very briefly, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, would be my testimony in this regard.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. The questions from committee members. Mr. Brown.
Chairman, I was asked a question about this bill earlier today, and we've had the judicial retirement matter up before us. One of the things we passed once got repealed by the voters when they didn't like our pay raise. I'm trying to reconstruct by looking here in Title 22, what do we give the judges right now other than the magistrates? And I'm not, there's enough of a quick study right now to answer that question. I see something about...
You don't know that the status of the existing law is the
judge. I've got a long description here, but a short description.
Well, they get what they used to have with no contributions.
Well, Well, they make no contribution, and they end up with something like 5% per year of service of...
Up to 75.
Up to 75, and that's still current. I didn't find a change in the supplement. Okay.
Is there any questions for Mr. Fisher?
No.
Sure.
And what is happening under Title 39 in Section 3 of the bill? Okay, I guess that's just taking them out of the PDRS or whatever.
No.
It's taking them out, is that right? That takes them out of the point, the retirement system they've been in. And that puts them, I see. And they get their contributions back. Mr. Chairman, I guess the only thing, the other thing I have is there's no such thing as a constituent member association of the Alaska Bar Association unless it's changed recently. And we are merely associations that exist coincidentally, in my case, as a member of the Tamaulipas Bar Association. It's a minor point.
Hopefully a matter of semantics.
Okay.
Is there any more questions?
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your attention and indulgence.
Okay.
All right. I think next person we have is Mr. Shelby Spriker.
That's correct. That's close enough, Mr. Chairman. It's Spriker.
Is it with an I?
No, with a D. Von Spriker in German, the original spelling.
Wouldn't that be Von Buschpieps?
If I could understand it, it would be all right. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity of coming and being able to participate in the legislative system that we have. I sit on the other side of interpretation sometimes, and I appreciate it. My name is Sheldon Spriker. I'm magistrate at Glen Allen. And I'd just like to comment on the bill in certain areas. That personally, I feel that it is necessary for us to be put under judicial retirement, primarily because we do the same functions as the district judge. We have the same responsibilities. And then some, as Mr. Heimler alluded to earlier, we do have the extra responsibilities that district judges do not. But financially, the aspects of the bill are not overbearing, I think, as far as budgetary considerations are concerned. There are 11 to 13 magistrates, I think, that would be included at this particular time. The Magistrate Association has agreed that we would even be willing to join a contributory retirement fund and not necessarily be bound by the particular statute the way it's written at the time, but if we get our contributions back, we have them deferred. When I started with the court system, I had been 7 years with the magistrates. My beginning salary was $393 a month. Since that time, I have progressed to where I'm in the $30,000 bracket. So the administration has been very kind and has worked very hard to upgrade the magistrate positions. And I don't think there's any magistrate in the state that would say differently. We have had excellent opportunities to accrue benefits. When I started, there was no health program. There was no retirement program. And in 72, we were allowed to sign up and start making payments into the PERS system. And last year, there was a bill that corrected all the outstanding magistrates, and they were allowed to participate in the PERS system. So there were no retirement benefits for several years, for many years, before statehood, and of course, up through the early parts of statehood, until 1972, I believe. And then the magistrates, since that time, have been able to participate in the PERS. I do feel that there are areas that are inequitable there, that judges are graduates of law school, or a member of the bar. Magistrates, as the most part, are not. They're laymen. However, the recent trend is to appoint attorneys as magistrates. So there are now several attorneys who are magistrates and who are not getting any type of judicial retirement as well. On a basis of law school training, there is no such thing as a course in being a judge in law school. There is only experience and common sense and interpretation of the law as it's on the statutes. And I don't know if being an attorney really has a strong bearing on the bench, only in technical matters. And I have resources through the library and through other attorneys if it's that technical that I can't answer.
I like that statement.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. And I also have confidence in Fish and Game. At least some of that I've worked with very well.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt once considered appointing a layman to the Supreme Court of the United States and asked Justice Douglas, who was sitting in the court then, and probably shouldn't have expressed an opinion on the subject, but then he would probably build that decision in 1944 because he couldn't get his appointees confirmed, and he was
thinking of appointing Robert LaPaulus Jr., a senator from Wisconsin, a senator, son of the famous senator, because he was in the Inn Club in the Senate, and they'd have to appoint him. But he wasn't a lawyer. And Justice Douglas at least tells the story that he said there was no question that a non-lawyer could be appointed to the Supreme Court of the United States, even though he never has been one. But you might enjoy that story.
That's primarily what I think. Okay. Questions from committee members? I have one question. How much retirement would you get under PDRS as opposed to under your proposed bill?
I believe it's 2% per year and maximum 50% at the end of 20 years. The judicial is 5%, maximum of 15 years at 75%. So it's lucrative for us. No one denies that. There's 50% compared to 75%, 15 years compared to 20 years. So we're aware of that. But we don't want to make it too selfish as far as the, I think the question is the other 50 magistrate positions, the 55 magistrate positions, are classified part-time and not full-time. What about them? We join the judicial retirement and they don't. That could be considered an equity. However, there are, most of those magistrates have full-time jobs and have benefits from their employment, whereas the full-time magistrates are just that. They work for the court system alone.
Sneak in a little question, unless the chairman calls me to the word, don't do it. How long do you say you've been a district court or a magistrate?
7 years, in January.
Are you familiar with the fact that the bill aging this committee that would, for lack of four votes, make it possible for magistrates with 10 years' experience to be considered as district court judges?
Yes, sir. I've heard that. I did not know the status of it, but I am aware there was a bill.
Well, the problem is that there was an erroneous view published in the press that it was addressed to one individual's needs, and it was not, and I'm trying to watch the bill. Anyway, it would seem that your testimony would also support that bill if we ever get back to it, Mr. Chairman. That's all I have.
Mr. Lyon.
I suspect that magistrates are a part of the judiciary system. Is that correct?
That would be an interesting question. We're not considered judicial officers in certain areas, and other areas we are, and we're considered classified employees in certain areas and unclassified employees in other areas. I didn't answer your question, but I don't really know if I can.
You're saying you're attorney also?
No, sir, I'm not attorney.
No, yeah, fine.
Well, I practice with that one. But we have a very unique classification, magistrates do, I think. There are no other state employees like us.
Here's another question. I was trying to put everything in how this relates to some things we passed last year. Now, maybe Mr. Bonding can enlighten me on this Legislative Board of Retirement Benefits, which deals with all systems in the state, retirement systems. There's some two pages. I wonder if this particular retirement thing would be involved in that board. That's a question I don't know.
Yeah,
but there's an answer. And another one that I have also that if in fact they are members of the judiciary, then they would fall under the Salary Commission, which conducts an ongoing review of compensation and retirement benefits for member legislature, governor, lieutenant governor, commission, deputy commissioner, so on and so forth, and members of the judiciary also. So do we have any conflict of those?
I think if you're looking back, the Salary Commission defines who's included. There's a definition of back there, and unless we change that definition,
at the present time, magistrates are not under the Salary Commission. We are, our salary is set by the Supreme Court.
Mm. Okay, then, question then about the retirement systems. The Board of Retirement deals with all retirement systems in the state now. Is there a conflict there?
What you pass it down, I think. Okay, is there any more questions for the witness?
The Legislative Board of Retirement, I thought that they just were a watchdog to the systems.
And they make recommendations.
Yeah, but they don't
matter. They have to review every bill. That's
every
right.
Bill. Before
that's
comes
right.
The rules. 30 days.
Oh, I see. Thank you very much.
I just wanted to get this, you know, for a fitting company. We have to do that.
Well, thank you,
sir.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Well, here's the real thing here. It says, before a bill which would have an effect on the retirement systems of the state if reported to the Rules Committee, there shall be attached to the bill an analysis of long-term and short-term costs to the state if the bill is adopted, as well as the impact of the bill on the actuarial soundness of the fund. The analysis shall be prepared by the Legislative Board of Retirement Benefits. So that does seem to say that...
Pretty mandatory.
Well, yeah, it says it's got to be a fiscal note by the Legislative Board of Retirement Board.
The 30 days after it, it's actually the legislation. The 30 days on.
Well, that one just says before the rules.
I think it's 30 days. But they can do. I mean, but I just, my question is, are we involved in these other boards or commissions or what?
Do you have any of the other magistrates here who want to test the parking lot?
Chairman of the committee, I'm Jeff Nicholson, referred to liberal remarks. I think you're going to hear some testimony today, probably from the administration, that all magistrates are full-time magistrates in the state of Louisiana. There was a bill passed last year that I think they did for purpose of putting them under PERS, say that they were full-time. However, you all know that most of the magistrates in the state have other jobs or their housewives. They only work 2 or 3 hours a day. In fact, the judicial canons even refer to part-time judges and part-time magistrates in the judicial canons. So they do recognize that there are part-time and full-time. I'm not going to bore you with a lot of statistics, but I would like to just briefly show, and I only have a 1976 report of the court system. The 77 should be out in a couple of 3 months. But in the top 10 courts, as far as filings, total filings in the top 10 courts are concerned, there are 3 of those in the top 10 that are manned by magistrates. There are also 3 of them that are outside the top 10 filing courts that are manned by district court judges, which shows that magistrates do have a considerable number of filings. In Kenai, in 1966, Kenai was number 3rd. We had 4,381 total filings, that's criminal and civil filings. So we are busy. We do quite a bit. I would also like to refer to one more section, which has to do with the district court dispositions for full-time equivalent judges. In other words, how many cases each judge has concluded during a year, disposed of. Anchorage ranks number 1st with 5,983 dispositions for full-time judges. Kenai ranks 2nd with 4,119 dispositions for full-time judges. And Fairbanks is 3rd, and it goes on of the top 12 in the system, 5 of them are manned by magistrates. It seems to me that those statistics warrant more than just a salary. It seems to me like they should warrant more. And I think that would conclude my testimony.
Is there questions between Mr. Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I tend to agree with the testimony. I just wanted this witness to do it because at least the tone of his testimony made it sound like maybe we were an antagonistic committee or something, but we aren't. Ms. Burke has seen us, throw gold in the direction of the judges for, 3 or 4 years anyway. So why should we change our long-standing tradition in this committee? I don't think that it's fantastic for life. But I think it's a good bill, and I appreciate that we should follow the law we passed last year with regard to a review of the effect on the retirement system. That was a very necessary thing because the political pressures are such that we were getting so many bills in and so many laws about retirement systems that we did not want to end up in a situation like New York and some other states where retirement systems get depleted or are not handled responsibly. So that's the reason for that bill. I guess it's just inadvertent on everybody's part. This bill had earlier been referring to that group.
Not everybody.
There was a bill introduced by Representative Malone last year, which was House Bill 456, which is similar to this bill. I think the basic difference being that Representative Malone's bill was a contributory bill, and this bill is not.
It's aging in our file right here.
I think it's been said that we don't really object to which one is contributory or not.
Questions from the other committee members?
sorry.
Your last statement was you think that the work that the magistrates do requires more than a salary, deserves more than a salary.
I think so, because we're bound to the same judicial canons full-time magistrates are as far as other outside activities are concerned, whereas the part-time magistrates, a lot of them hold full-time jobs outside of the community.
But you do have a retirement.
We have to proceed.
Yeah, I mean, the way you said it, it implied to me that you...
No, I'm sorry about that.
You do have...
Questions from other members? What is the average? Isn't such a thing as an average salary for the average magistrate?
I think there are four salary magistrates, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and I, the moment to me, I think the top magistrate salary is $28,000 plus
I think the lowest one is around 5,000.
Perhaps Susan had a
full-time.
I think it's around
5,500.
Is it 8, the lowest one?
Full-time?
Part-time.
Well,
no,
I'm talking about full-time people.
No, there's four classes of salary.
I think it's 28, about 24.
21
and 28. 21 and 28, or 24 and 28.
There's two full-time classifications and two part-time classifications.
Well, we're only dealing with full-time people here, aren't we?
That's what the bill says.
Yes.
Okay, the bill's particular people. What type of salaries are they making?
I think it's 21 and 28. 24 and 28 is the base. Let's see what...
Thank you. We've been passing notes back and forth, exchanging scandal stories about this and that.
Mrs. Oshie?
could I just read it, or would you want me just to read it?
Oh, okay. Is it short or long?
It's not very long.
Okay, why don't you just read it for us and then leave it alone?
All right.
Is it from you or someone else?
No, it's from Dorothy Saxton, who is our magistrate at Palmer.
Oh, okay.
And she asked if I would read this for you. My main concern is that this committee understands that magistrates are dedicated people with many hats to wear. We are at the grassroots of these systems and meet the public on their first encounter of a problem. Other judges meet these same defendants, but usually only after they have had their first court contact. This means the superior court judges and the justices. As full-time magistrates, we deal with all types of problems and people. We live with these people and their surroundings every day. As you can recall, I have been in this position for many years and have made do and done without the beautiful plush surroundings that many judges have enjoyed for years. I now have a beautiful building and am proud of it. However, I recall the days of makeshift boxes, too. I have enjoyed and dedicated my life to my job and serving the people as their judge, and have people of all positions in life come to me to ask for assistance and guidance. Many of these are legal people and attorneys of long practice, thus rewarding my hours and long years serving them. The Honorable Tony Diamond appointed me to this position and said, "Never have a case before you without putting a little heart into it." I've tried, and trust I may have the privilege of continuing to do what the law says, tempered with common sense and love of my fellow beings. Best wishes, Dorothy Saxton.
Thank you, Mrs.
Thank you.
Being not a judge or a magistrate, I'm not going to say too many things. I revealed this before you, of course, it's pretty much I sponsored on request. And the things that I was going to say was pretty much been wrapped up by the magistrates here. And I had hoped that we would have gotten some response from the administration as far as what I know that they're probably going to oppose this. So that's just about it. If you have any questions,
any questions from the committee members? Thank you, Lynn. Hugh, did you want to?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I believe it was mentioned in earlier testimony that I do have similar legislation pending in this committee that was introduced last year. And it's along the lines of House Bill 727. The basic difference is that the other legislation would also establish a judicial contributory retirement system. But basically, Mr. Chairman, I do support House Bill 727. The reason that I do is that I think that, I know the argument's made many times with respect to retirement system questions, but I think it is a matter of equity. You have people that have all the responsibilities, usually of a district court judge. They're working full-time. They're dealing with basically the same type of cases. They have to meet the same ethical standards. And for some arbitrary reason, they're excluded from the benefits of the judicial retirement system. And I think that it is a matter of equity to include those people in the judicial retirement system. That's why I support the legislation. I don't have any comments as to the cost. I haven't seen a fiscal note. I am sending a request to the board, retirement board that the legislature established. I noticed that they had not made any comments on any of the pending legislation on judicial retirement. I asked them for comments on this legislation. But I think it's a matter of equity. And except for the title, whatever's in a name, there's no reason that these people should not be included under the judicial retirement system. You can argue about the cost, I admit, and I understand that there's a difference as of opinion as the actuarial impact of the legislation. That's something I think probably could be settled by a report from the retirement board. But only reason that I would back off support of the legislation if someone could show me why the legislation was not equitable. And I haven't heard any arguments made in that direction. And I'll be glad to try to answer any questions that people have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr.
Long?
He won't let me say what I wanted to say about it.
Susan Burke.
For the record, I'm Susan Burke, staff counsel for the Administrative Office of the State Court System. And I come here feeling a little bit awkward opposing a bill that would extend benefits to employees of the court system. But in any event, I am here to oppose this bill. This isn't the first time this question has come up. It was included in Representative Malone's bill last year, and there was some talk of introducing similar legislation in the Senate. Our Chief Justice corresponded, I know, with the President of the Senate, and I'm not sure with the Speaker of the House, in opposition. So the Supreme Court, at least, has gone on record as not favoring the extension of judicial retirement benefits to the magistrates. Basically, the reasons are as follows. There are some philosophical reasons, and then some technical problems to doing it. And I'll get into the philosophical things first very briefly. First of all, it isn't any secret that the judicial retirement system is expensive and it's generous to those who are included under it. And in thinking about this proposition, we asked the question whether the reasons for having a distinct and generous retirement program hold true for magistrates as well as for judges. And we really don't think that those reasons or purposes could hold true. I see two basic purposes to having a judicial retirement system along the lines that we have now. The first is to attract people of the highest possible qualifications in the middle of, hopefully, in the middle of successful law careers, to attract them to take a job on the bench. One of those attractions is an attempt to balance out what a lawyer might give up in terms of future or potential earnings in a law career. The second purpose is to provide a source of fairly inexpensive assistance, judicial assistance, by use of retired judges as pro tem judges. The bench in Alaska is fairly young at this point, but very gradually judges are beginning to retire, and we do have judges now available who can and do serve pro tem for the difference between what their retirement pay is and what current salary is. So when we have fluctuations in caseload and we get into a crunch, we can call upon these people who come back and assist for not very much money. With respect to this latter purpose, when you get into this kind of caseload crunch and you've got Superior Court cases on the calendar, you can't go out and take someone from the street, if you will, to serve pro tem. They have to be real Superior Court judges who've gone through the gubernatorial appointment process. With magistrates, if we have a caseload crunch, you literally can put out a recruitment bulletin, and within a relatively short period of time, the presiding judge can appoint a magistrate. So the second purpose doesn't really apply with respect to the magistrate, nor I think does the first. And I don't mean to sound ungrateful by any means with respect to the work that the magistrates have done or the service that they've given. I'm perfectly aware of the terrifically good work and level of work that a number of our magistrates have been performing. But we simply don't have the recruitment or market situation with respect to recruiting for magistrates that you do with judges. Now, this relates to some extent to Mr. Brown's bill that he had in. But when you're trying to attract judges.
Which the court system imposed, Mr. Brown?
Yes.
After being told by some justices in the Supreme Court to be
But in any event, we just don't have the same kinds of recruiting problems. Dealing with a narrow field where the participants in the field are hopeful of making their way and making their way with some financial benefit. Sometimes that happens, sometimes it doesn't happen, but in any event, that's the area from which we're trying to recruit judges. And from time to time, we really have had trouble getting people to apply for judgeship. I'm not sure that salary, and for sure, was at least a factor in the recent instance, I think, in Fairbanks, where it was very, very hard. We had to open recruitment twice. But in any event, obviously we want to attract good magistrates and good people to the system, and I think we have. But we want to attract good employees at all levels in the court system. We want to have good clerks of court. We hope to have good staff counsel for the administrative office. And so far, the PERS system has been a sufficient inducement with respect to recruiting qualified employees within other areas of employment in the court system. There are also some technical things that could cause problems in the future. It's true that there are definite distinctions in certain areas between full-time and part-time magistrates. The leave statutes under Title 39 make a distinction between magistrates who serve the state on less than a full-time basis with respect to inclusion in the leave benefit statute. But there's a...
When you're on that point, full-time, is the word full-time have any distinction with, since it is used in statutes presently? I mean, if we pass a statute that says full-time magistrates, does the court system know who we're talking about?
Well, sometimes yes and sometimes no.
How do you figure it out now?
Well, we sort of survey around, and the people who seem, you know, caseload, I suppose, has something to do with it, and the people who were fairly confident are staying at their desks from 8 to 4:30 with something useful to do during that time are considered full-time magistrates. But I see the distinctions beginning to blur and get a little bit more confused in certain areas. For retirement purposes, all magistrates are considered full-time because they're on call 24 hours. Salary levels are to some extent dependent on the amount of time that is necessary for a magistrate to spend in actual duties, but that's really not the only factor. But beyond that, when you're getting into judicial retirement as opposed to PERS, you're assuming that you've got a standard uniform salary base on which to base the benefit. Under PERS, I think it's whatever percent you've accumulated times the highest 3 years. I know less about my own system than I do about the judge's system, but I think that's the way it works. But, and with the judges, you have uniform salaries. All district court judges make the same amount of money throughout the state, and the same with the other levels. But you don't have that with magistrates. The other thing that you've got that's a little bit confusing is that the salaries can fluctuate up and down. Magistrates are not under the constitutional protection with respect to salary that other judges in the system are, certainly Superior and Supreme Court. So salaries can go up and down with respect to a particular magistrate pool. If you have a caseload rise and fall for some reason, given the economic circumstances of a particular community, you can have the same person sitting in a magistrate post for 10 years, and maybe the salary goes up and maybe the salary goes down. The person retires, the salary could continue to go down, or at least go down relative to other magistrates. We picked on this four levels of magistrate salary several years ago because it seemed to work and it seemed to be fairly equitable. But it may not always be the best way to work out salaries, equitable salaries among the magistrates. And at this point in time, the legislature has given the Supreme Court authority to set magistrate salaries. So it's subject to fluctuations within it, and there may be problems figuring out what the proper salary base is. Again, that's a technical thing that I assume great minds could overcome. Were one in favor of the bill in particular. The other problem is, what do you do about a person who becomes a magistrate, say, starts out part-time, the caseload rises, starts working full-time for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, say 5 years for purposes of vesting, and then because of the economies of the community, the caseload goes way down, the person stops being a full-time magistrate. Are they entitled to service credit for the years previously as a part-time magistrate? Do they have to be a part-time magistrate or a full-time magistrate at the time of retirement? And on and on and on. I mean, you can see a number of technical problems that might occur with figuring out whether someone is in fact entitled to benefits as a full-time magistrate. A district court judge or a superior court judge, they're always assumed to be full-time. You either are one or you aren't one, and there isn't any possibility of question about it, at least based on external forces, certainly such as fluctuations in the caseload. Magistrate posts also get abolished and reestablished in other locations, again, based on the needs for judicial service. I guess I would say that with respect to the question of equity that has been raised, I don't know whether my answer would be considered satisfactory, but I guess I view the judicial retirement system as not so much a reward for service well done in the past as an attraction for good people whom you hope and expect will provide top quality service. Obviously, there are some rewards for past service involved in that, but I think the primary fundamental purpose is at the beginning of the service, the attraction, as opposed to looking back and saying, Magistrate so-and-so has done, or Judge Carlson has done a magnificent job and therefore deserves a great retirement. I guess I don't view the system and the purposes of it in that way.
Is there questions for Ms. Burke?
Madam Commissioner, what is the position of the court system, if any, were we to instead establish a contributory retirement system for the magistrates different from the PERS, along the lines of the bill that you will not let me call a Dyson bill, House Bill 456?
I'm not sure. My brief does not extend beyond this particular bill, I don't have a sense of how the Supreme Court would view that. I could certainly find out if the committee's interested in it.
Mrs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to come back, Mr. Chairman, to a question you raised earlier is the distinction between full-time and part-time magistrates. Specifically, I'd like to ask how the court system makes this determination at this time.
As I understand it, it's simply a matter of at some point in time, and I'm not sure that we always catch it at an accurate time in terms of applying, say, the leave system to a particular magistrate. It simply becomes known over a period of time that caseload and workload have risen to the point that full-time services of a magistrate are required.
Is that when you don't have a system?
Does it sound that way? I guess maybe we don't have a system.
You have an ad hoc system?
Yeah, we hear it on the street. I don't know. I guess we don't have a system for it.
You don't have something case by case.
We don't have a monitoring thing. We don't have a particular number of filing at which we say you're full time. I mean, it's done on a post by post basis. And hopefully, as I say, we say, you're full time for purposes of leave without causing any problems.
Mr. Chairman, it's not clear to me right now whether or not the court system actually makes that distinction. I guess I have to press the question. Does the court system at present discriminate as to full-time personnel, the magistrates are part-time personnel? How do they do it, and what effect does that have, say, on things like salaries?
With respect to salaries, it has a peripheral effect. Because a magistrate is full-time, wouldn't necessarily entitle that post to a certain level of salary. At the present time, the salary structure is such that the full-time people who are in full-time position are distinguished from those serving part-time. We're forced to make the distinction with respect to leave benefits. Full-time magistrates are under the regular leave statutes accruing leave benefits just as any other state employee does, and I assume with rights of cash payoff at the end upon termination and that sort of thing. Other judges and part-time magistrates have leave benefits as provided by Supreme Court rule. Am I answering your question? I'm not sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I have enough of an answer to believe at least that, say, if a statute were enacted requiring that the distinction be made, that you could do that, at least as of the effective date of the act, because apparently there's some sort of system, even though it's ad hoc in effect now, that under which that determination is made, at least for purposes of leave. Is that correct?
If required to be made, it could be made, because we are doing it as best we can, and I now realize there's no real system at all with respect to leaves. Sure, it could be done.
Is there any questions?
All employees fiduciary system run under the PERS, except
right.
The judges.
That's right.
You and everyone that works for the court system.
That's right.
You said something about all magistrates are full-time for retirement purposes. What do you mean?
Oh, there was in the development of magistrate coverage under PERS, there was a time when it was unclear whether magistrates were covered at all, if the gentleman sitting over there can correct me if I'm wrong. Until recently, and it may even still be true, part-time employees, PERS was extended to part-time employees very recently. Prior to that time, magistrates who were considered serving part-time weren't entitled to any retirement benefit. It was an inequitable sort of situation because they'd been serving for years and years. So we tried to work partly with the legislation, but also administratively with the retirement people to come to grips with distinctions between a magistrate who's on call all the time and working, say, 20 hours a week for the magistrate working 30 hours a week. It's pretty hard to monitor a magistrate mnemonic to say whether or not the work is actually being done. So we got into terrific administrative problems as to how to prorate time and retirement benefits. So we finally threw up our hands and said, we asked them to treat all magistrates as full-time for purposes of PERS, and they agreed to do that. So that was handled largely in administrative.
What you're saying is the part-time magistrate who makes $7,500 a year.
I don't know what the...
And the full-time was making $28,000. They both vested. They start to work January 1, 1978. They vest at the same time. Even though one's on full-time, the other one has a job. It only puts part-time in them as a magistrate. But they both, in 5 years, are vested.
I think that's how... I'd have to check for sure with the retirement people to see if distinctions are made along those lines. There were inequities on both sides doing it.
Do you have a statement of how much it's going to cost?
No.
If this bill passes?
No, we don't. We could, I suppose, prepare one, but if the retirement board is going to do that anyway, and their figures, I'm sure, would be as accurate as all. I can do one. Have one prepared if you want.
The law that we passed last year, as you read it, requires that it be ready by the time it gets out of court.
Requires two things. Requires that either that both that we prepare 30 days after the bill is introduced, and that it also be done before the bill moves and rules.
I would feel very uncomfortable acting on the bill.
You've sent requests that you think is necessary for us to send a different request.
We must have it by March 5.
I mean, did you send an official request to them, or did you just get it?
The request is sitting on my desk right now, Mr. Chairman. I've got a sign to send it out, but it didn't come to my attention until after reviewing the report that the board submitted that they were not taking into account the judicial retirement legislation. I suppose because we've got TRS and TRS people on the board is the reason, but it is under their authority and responsibility in the law. So he's going to ask for that information on all the pending legislation affecting judicial retirement. But if the committee has a request on this specific bill, it might be well to make it separately so that the board would expedite that.
Mr. Malone?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go back over something here in terms, I guess, of the philosophy of the thing, which is a subject, I suppose, it faces itself. As I understood the testimony here, that the reason for the retirement system was to attract people, apparently, rather than keep them. How about this? About the salaries in the system, Ms. Burke, is that same general rule apply that the salaries that are paid are, you know, should be at a high enough level to attract good people to them?
Yeah, I didn't mean to suggest that keeping people off the bench wasn't also a purpose of the retirement, but I guess I saw it as primarily, the primary purpose as the attraction. No, sure. I mean, if you have a good retirement system, that's going to keep people on once you've attracted them, and the same is true of salary.
Sure. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, what I was going to say is that if salaries in retirement were sort of a net that you used to catch people, then when a salary increase went into effect, it seems like to me it only applied to new people, but generally we apply it to those already in the system. So I think that the question of equity really is there. I don't think it can be dismissed by an argument that this is also an attraction or inducement to have people come into the system. That's basically what my point is.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative,
talk to the chair. Sure.
Yeah.
Just for the record, another non-assumption speaker. Address myself to the question. I think what it comes down to on this, and I'm sorry I had to leave, but I had a meeting, so perhaps some of this is duplicate, but I think what it comes down to is, are these people serving a judicial function? I don't mean a judicial employment function. I mean, are they serving as the lowest level of judges? If indeed they are, then I think they're entitled to the retirement system. If they're not, if they're just state employees who happen to draw a judicial department paycheck, then I suppose they should stay with TDRS. But having observed the magistrate, for instance, from Haynes in action over the years, and reflecting the way that Jamie Fisher spoke about the magistrate in Kenai, I'm of the very strong opinion that these are indeed judges, you know, the lowest level of judges, and therefore they should receive the judges' retirement the same. Obviously, since they are at the bottom level, the percentage factor, since we deal with percentages, they're going to get the lowest retirement thing too, and that's all right too, just like district judges get less than superior judges, and Superior Court judges get less than Supreme Court judges. That's all just built into the system just because of the multiplier. But to me, all we're talking about is fairness on this thing. Several quick technical questions were raised on how do you solve some of these problems. Well, I think one by one, you just sit down at a table and you let the PDRS people or the retirement people or the judiciary people sit down at a table and
and spend about 30 minutes on each question, and I think you come up with a workable answer. You know, I could suggest solutions to the very problems that were raised here a few minutes ago myself, but I think we all could. But those are just technical problems. I don't see any really policy reason or any reason to vote no on the thing because of the questions exist. That's all. But I thank you.
Any questions for Representative Miller? Thank you.
Well,
I think we take care of all the testimony. We have a slight problem now, so we don't have a quorum to take any action. So I guess what we'll do in the meantime is we'll request formally a fiscal note or a report from the Chairman Legislative Retirement Committee.
One point on that, Mr. Chairman. The legislation is written in State House Bill 727, talks about full-time magistrates, and I think we better have that definition down in writing, because there seems to be some difficulty in establishing what that means before you ask the board, or else I think you're going to get back the same kind of answer. It's going to walk around on it.
I think you can send that north to Susan, and she can supply us with the definition of purpose.
Mr. Chairman?
Not
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
Let's follow up on that. Apparently, the court system does have a mechanism or procedure, a way of reaching a decision right now as to who's a full-time magistrate, at least for some particulars, and I think that the definition ought to include that.
We're going to have to confess in writing now that we don't have a system.
House Judiciary Committee meeting February 10th, 1978, adjourned 4:48 p.m.